the Million Dollar Mortgage Experience Podcast.
All right, welcome to today's podcast. Today we have a special guest, Kyle Bucket. He's a retired Navy SEAL leader, a former executive of a publicly traded company, and he now sits on several boards and is soon to be a New York Times best-selling author. Yeah. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So glad you could fly in from Texas, and yeah. I know you're doing a bunch of podcasts to promote your book.
It's a great time to be in San Diego because it's 105 degrees in Austin, Texas right now with 98% humidity. I wake up in San Diego this morning and I'm like, ooh, throw on a little jacket. It's glorious. I love it.
Oh yeah, we're spoiled here for sure. That's a brutal weather.
I love it. I love San Diego. You guys are spoiled.
We are so spoiled. So
for those of you who don't know, I lived here for 23 years.
Hard to leave here, right?
Well, so we left San Diego in 2021 for Austin. And then this year, 2023, we actually got a little two-bedroom, two-bath condo so that we can come back.
Nice.
My wife comes back quite often, but I'll tell you what, that has been such a godsend having that little two-bedroom.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. That's awesome. Great.
Yeah.
Well, Navy SEAL, tell me what caused you to want to go down that path of life?
So it's funny. I grew up in New York just across the river from West Point.
Okay.
So I had a lot of, Army around me, as a kid going to Army football games, hockey games, basketball games at West Point was a very common occurrence. Okay. And back then, Chuck Norris had these movies, he had these movies around him being, in the Army. And so right around 17 years of age, I was like, I really want to go and serve the country in a special and elite way. Mm-hmm. And this is the 90s, right? And so Chuck Norris is what I had. It's what I grew up with in the 80s. And until one day my dad comes home from work and he goes, hey, you love the water. You love the ocean. Mm-hmm. You love rivers, lakes, pools, anything that's just water. You love jumping in it and you love being in it all day. You've been like that since you're 4 years old. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I know, duh. He's like, check this out. And he gives me a book about Navy SEALs. And I didn't know what they were. I'm like, what is this? He goes, this is the elite. He goes, you should read on this. So I stayed up till 5 o'clock that night, 5 o'clock in the morning. And I pounded the entire book.
Wow.
My mom comes walking. She's like, what are you doing up? I'm like, Mom, I'm training to be a Navy SEAL. I can't sleep. I have to stay awake for a week. And so I was hook, line, and sinker. I was sold. So I'm 17 and I'm like, that's all I want to do. And I'm begging my parents to sign the dotted line because in the military, if you want to join at 17, you have to have parental consent and they wouldn't do it. So fast forward to literally the morning of my 18th birthday, I'm sitting on the steps waiting for the Navy recruiter to open the door. Wow. And I signed the dotted line.
Wow. You wanted it bad.
Bad. Big time. Big
and
time.
And so did you go in to be a Navy SEAL or did you go into just the Navy?
No, like I signed a Navy SEAL contract. That's cool. And joined with that sole focus.
That's awesome.
Going into the teams. Yeah. Yeah.
So what was the process like once you signed? I mean, I'm sure it was brutal, or were you already kind of trained and ready to go?
So I was trained. I was in pretty good shape. I wasn't there in my maturity, though. Hmm. So I get to Buds, and I get in trouble, right? I get in trouble for underage drinking. Okay. So back then, this is pre-9/11, and so not that there is now, but there wasn't any concessions made to knuckleheads like me, right? Yeah. And so I get kicked out. Ooh. I have to go to a ship for 2.5 years. I actually did 3 deployments, which is actually kind of cool because I got to see the world. I mean, I sailed all through the Mediterranean, the North Atlantic, the Baltic. I mean, I went to Russia.
Wow.
Copenhagen, Denmark. I mean, I was
saw a bunch of countries.
Yeah,
that's cool.
Yeah. Italy, like 7 times. Wow. Greece, Turkey, a couple of times, and then in the Middle East. And we're doing, boardings in the Middle East for oil infringements. And so finally, I matured up a little bit and I went back and I got to go back. But there's, you know, two and a half years where I was hating life.
Yeah.
Not doing what I wanted to do. It,
right?
Yeah, like they, big time.
If you underage drinking, they're just like, boom, yeah. no second chances. Yeah.
Big time. Wow. So I come back. Now I'm a little more mature, thank God. And I made it through. Awesome. And we had a small buds class. It was a winter hell week. Shout out to my brothers in 249. Winter hell week where, you know, the water, the ocean, for those of you who don't know in San Diego, I'm sure many do, but like in February, water got down to 51.
It's cold.
We were like the second week of February for our hell week and it was freezing.
That's like ice bath level.
Yeah. So we started out with like 135 guys. And by the time we were done with Hell Week at 51 degrees Fahrenheit, ocean water, there's 17 of us left.
Wow.
Yeah. It was nuts.
I heard it's like a 15% success rate. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting, right? Like it's 20,000 guys and gals now walk into a Navy recruiter's office around the world, not just America, but around the world. About 20,000 a year walk in and say, hey, I want to do that.
Yeah.
Out of that, 10,000 actually join the Navy. Out of that 10,000, about 2,500. And I'm estimating, I'm not perfect on my numbers, sure. But around 2,500 get to BUDS, Basic Underwater Demolition School. And then out of that 2,500, we make around 250 every year.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a small percentage.
It's a small. I remember back in 2005, was it? I think it was like right around 2005, 2007, somewhere in there. We literally netted one.
Really?
Like the whole force, because guys were dying, guys were retiring, or guys were just transitioning out of service, and literally we netted one.
Wow. Yeah. That's crazy.
Like we increased the force size. Say it was 2,000 guys. It was now 2,001 guys.
Yeah. Wow.
A year.
Yeah. I have a total mad respect for, you know, what you guys did, and thank you for serving and our freedom and all that. So that's really cool.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for the support.
What you went on some deployments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tell us a story from one of your deployments that you can share.
Oh, so this one, I love sharing this one. This one's pretty powerful. In 2012, we had gotten Mad Dog Mattis to approve a massive operation. This is one of my biggest operations I'd ever done. To put it in perspective, we had an 800-man Marine element. We had 24 tanks, 23 helicopters for insertion, and an Army Corps of Civil Engineers with their 22 vehicles that were going to build us roads and bridges as we cleared through a 4x7 mile stretch of land, like a valley, kind of like Mission Valley, if you will. Mm-hmm. Like that was the height of the ridgeline on the south, where like, you know, like where Normal Heights is and all that area. Like we're kind of clearing through Mission Valley. Think of it like that. And while we're doing it, the reason we were doing it was actually to set ourselves up for success. Cause we had just finished our mission. We were demobilizing our location. We had spread white space. We had been there for 7 or 8 months at this point. And we were going to go and replicate that all over again. I should back up a little bit. We were doing what's called unconventional warfare. We were working by, through, and with, you know, the local population to establish democracy in the region. Mm-hmm. And so we were building, a police force, a security force, an element, working through the local and tribal leaders to, you know, remove Taliban from the region. Mm-hmm. And we had done that successfully. And now we're going to go do it again. But before we were going to go set up in a new spot, we wanted to clear it out, right? So, and we needed a massive element. So we're clearing it out. We're moving through it. And on like day two or day three, in the middle of the day, broad daylight, me and a small element of SEALs are kind of shadowing from the ridgeline, the Marine element as they're pushing through. Right. And we see some Taliban maneuvering on the Marines, Like they're gonna get ambushed because they're pushing through, so they're like clearing houses, right? Mm-hmm. As well as they're kind of pushing through and they're engaging with the local population as well. You know, politically correctly, you know, yeah. It's not just like running through and breaking everything. We're doing it very methodically because there's a lot of innocent people in this right. valley as well, right? And so we see this Taliban maneuvering on these guys, and so we're gonna go do Kyle Bucket's favorite piece of artillery, which is called a HIMAR. So I grab my, and I'll explain in a minute. I grab my JTAC, and we kind of scurry up a little hillside to get a better viewpoint mm-hmm. to laze the target, to call in the fire support from the HIMAR. Now a HIMAR is a Kyle Bucket's favorite. Tool or weapon, which is a picture like an 18-wheeler truck mm-hmm. where the back trailer is like kind of cut in half. It's just a half. It's a short bed almost, okay. right? And on that back half, there's a box that sits rockets, right? Oh, okay. And missiles.
Like laser guided? Or
yep. Okay. Yep, exactly. Now, this truck is probably parked 40 or 50 miles away from us.
Wow.
And when we call it in, they launch the missile that goes up to 90,000 feet AGL, above ground level, and then comes down within a 5-meter precision of the target. It's incredible. That's and sick. when it comes down, it's in, I mean, if you're like 500, 1,000 yards away, you just see this massive explosion and fireball, and then you go 1,000. And then you hear the sound and it's like boom, right? But you see, if you're like a 1,000 yards away,
yeah, you see it first.
You see it first before you hear anything. Wow. It's amazing.
That's crazy.
It's amazing. So anyway, I grab my JTAG, which is a joint terminal air controlman, KB. His name's actually KB too. It's funny. One of my best friends still this day. He and I scurry up the hill. And we're about to call it in, and it's just he and I, and all of a sudden he just gives me a massive like elbow to like the rib, and I'm like, dude, I'm like, what? And I look at him, I'm like, dude, and he's just like, and he's pointing at the ground, and I'm like, and I look down on the ground, and I'm like, oh, you've got to be kidding me! Undeniably, we are standing on an IED. Improvised explosive device. We're standing on, it's clear as day. The ground scars are there. All of the signs are there. We can see the wires. I mean, it's undeniable. We're standing.
You can't move.
Can't move. So we're like, now, in this moment, and this whole story is like, you know, seconds, right?
Yep.
Seconds. We were going to get up there. We were going to go, okay, ding, ding, lays, boom, and get back down.
Right.
Right? It was going to be seconds. We were exposed. We're extremely exposed because we're on this hillside. At any point in time, we could get hit with an RPG from the valley. Mm-hmm. We're completely exposed. Completely wow. exposed. So it's like we could take fire, PKM, RPG, whatever. We're like, you gotta be kidding me. And so like right then and there, I'm like, this is how I'm gonna die. This sucks. And dude, clear as day, audibly, I hear, I've got you. And I'm like, God, is that you?
Whoa.
And I'm like, I look at him. He didn't hear it. And I'm like, holy moly. I think I just heard God talk to me. Like wow. Clear as day. Like calm, but pure power.
Mm.
Pure power, but calm. And I was like, oh. So I look at him and I'm like, dude, you first. And he's like about to argue, but the thing is, he's 60 pounds lighter than me.
Yeah.
So like maybe if it's, you know, a pressure release, this was not an act of heroism at all. I must be very clear. It was not an act of heroism. I was just trusting God got me. And in the sense of like, okay, if he's got me, then I'm okay. So like maybe KB should go, and he's lighter than me. And he's about to like argue like, dude. And then he's like, he knows it's the right call. He knows it's a tactical right call. Like he's like
had training about what to do if you step on it.
But we're exposed.
Yeah.
Right. Like that's the problem in this situation. We're completely.
So one way or the other, you're going to get either hit any or second. You're going to blow up.
Yeah. I mean, literally, it's the middle of the day. It was like.
And how often do IEDs like misfire or don't blow up? Like, is it? Was there an odds there? Like, where you?
I'm about to explain that okay. one yeah, about, around going. This. So
got me hanging on the edge of my seat.
Yeah, so he scurries down the hill, and as soon as he's at MSD or assumed minimum safe distance, I hear him come up on the radio because our protocol is, hey, this could be a radio frequency controlled device. Don't chirp on your radio. Mm. Don't send out any electronic signals. Right. So he and I go comms dark, comms black when we're standing on it, right?
Yep.
Now, when he gets down to the bottom of the hill, I hear him chirping, and I'm just sitting there like, oh, I'm like, you got to be kidding me. I'm like, I think that was you, Lord. I think that was you that was talking to me. And I hear him talking on the radio now, and the EOD guys, the explosive ordnance disposal guys, are an hour away, right? And so like I'm like, oh, man. And all of a sudden, again, I hear it. I've got you.
Wow.
And I'm like, ooh, man. And it sends chills down my body. And I'm like, okay, Lord, if that was you, I believe that was you. If that wasn't you, Lord, I'm sorry. Please forgive me of all my sins. I've had many. Watch over my wife. I didn't have kids yet. And I'm like, all right, I think that was you, Lord. I think that was you. And I hear it again. I've got you.
Wow.
And I'm like, all right, boom. So I get off and I run down the hill. Obviously, I'm okay.
Yep.
EOD, we mark it. EOD does get there 90 minutes later, and they unearth what was the equivalent of 10 pounds of TNT.
Oh my!
And it was 9 inches below the ground, buried. And so if it would have went off, what had happened was it was a pressure release, meaning the second I stepped off, it detached. And explodes, yeah. Right? It didn't. There, and they couldn't explain it. EOD wow. was like, "We have no idea why it didn't go off."
Wow.
They're like, "Thank." Literally, the guy's like, "Hey, thank God, huh?" And I'm like, "Dude,
you bet,
you bet." Let me tell you about this story. And so if that thing had gone off, if I would have lived, my reproductive organs would not. have lived. I would not have my three kids. My three beautiful children would not be alive. I wouldn't have my legs. KB's two beautiful daughters wouldn't be with us, nor would he have legs either or reproductive organs if we would have even lived.
Man,
yeah,
that's so, heavy.
Thank you, Jesus. Yeah. Thank you, God.
That's heavy, man.
Yeah.
So when you get off that and you make it out okay, like you just have to have a whole renewed kind of I can't imagine the feeling that you just dodged the massive bullet.
Right, right. Or if you're me, you're a knucklehead for a couple more years until you really come back to Jesus and just stand up one day and rededicated my life. You know, years later, I was selfish and I was a knucklehead. I was dealing with issues and all this stuff for years, and then finally one day I'm sitting in church literally, and. I heard 1 John 4:9, I believe it is, where he is faithful to forgive.
Mm-hmm.
And I rededicated my life right there on the spot. Wow. And since then, came out with a book.
Yeah. Well, you've done some other things along the way, right? Yeah. So after retiring, there was a One More Wave charity that you did, right? That helped veterans surf, right? They get back on get on their boards and stuff.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Oh man, One More Wave, so near and dear to my heart. I love it. So when Alex started it, the goal was to provide customized surfing equipment to wounded and disabled veterans.
Okay.
And the methodology was, hey, we have, myself included, have received so much mental therapy from being out in the ocean and surfing, right? Like I can tell when I'm starting to dry out a little bit and I need to get back in the water and hit some waves. And so, you know, we thought, hey, if we can provide this type of recreational therapy to wounded, disabled veterans, like how beneficial will this be?
Right.
And so we did. We started, you know, he started building boards with a shaper actually right over here, not far from you guys on the other side of the 805 split. And we started customizing surfboards built and tailored to their individual need or requirement. Because you know, if you're missing a leg, your buoyancy requirement's different.
Oh yeah. Right? I can't imagine how you'd figure out how to surf again.
Right.
It'd be tough.
Right.
Yeah.
Or if you're missing an arm,
right.
Right. A handle is going to be very beneficial for you. And you know, maybe fin, we've moved the fin placement forward more on a board for a prone surfer than maybe we would for a fully able bodied surfer. And so we started out just focusing on that. And then we started realizing this whole other aspect of it too, which I'm really proud of, is we started realizing the community aspect of it. Because now you're, where else in the world is there this gathering of a community of disabled veterans that are also surfing
right.
So it just vibes, it just makes sense. And so we started promoting the community aspect and really, you know, helping and empowering it through tech. And now I'm really proud to say that they have, you know, these chapters all across the U.S. They in Guam, in Puerto Rico, in Hawaii, all around the coastal America, where if you're a guy or gal that's in the One More Wave community, and you're like, hey, I'm traveling, I live in San Diego, or I live in Virginia, or I live in Florida, and I'm traveling to a different location, they can get on the thread. Mm-hmm. They can reach out to the community and be like, hey, I'm in Florida today. It looks like there's really good surf. I've never surfed this spot. I don't know anything about it, and I don't have any legs. Someone give me a hand? And boom, someone will be on the thread and be like, hey, I'll be there, man. Wow. My name's John. I'll be wearing a red hat and a red t-shirt, and I'll give you a hand, whatever you need.
That's so cool.
Dude, and those meetups are happening daily all across the world now.
Wow.
And the community is, 10,000 people strong of, supporters, donors, surfers. It's incredible. It's incredible to watch.
It's incredible that you've matched those two things together. Because surfing, I know, I mean, I'm not a surfer. I'm learning.
Let's go.
So, I've caught some waves, but I'm still learning on longboard, but, sure. It's just so therapeutic being there. And it's just takes your mind off of everything else. You like
really does.
Very focused, really very does. Present. And I can't only imagine like what that would do to someone who's got, stuff going on, PTSD or whatever it is. I mean, it just takes your mind off everything else, and you just focus on the waves and the water.
It's so true. It's so true. Because cool. In that moment, your sole focus, it's like a data dump of your brain, right? Your brain just completely data dumps any other thoughts that you have going on, and you're focused on one thing only.
Yeah.
Like I can't think of a time. This would be an interesting conversation to have with some of my pro friends, but like I can't think of a time where I've been on a wave and I'm like, oh man, I need to do laundry today.
Yeah, you don't ever think about that.
You
got to call back this, get my insurance, or
completely. Oh, did I ink that deal yet? No, like it just, everything's gone.
Yeah.
And it's hard to replicate that.
Yeah.
Elsewhere.
That's cool.
It's cool.
So your book, let's talk about your book, Leadership is Overrated, How the Navy SEALs create self-leading teams that win. Is this about being autonomous? What's kind of the theme throughout it?
What happened for me is, I'm going to go back to that story I was just telling you about. In 2011, I get tasked with doing unconventional warfare in Afghanistan and working by, through, and with the local population to establish democracy in the region, right? That's the mission.
Mm-hmm.
And so I get assigned to SEAL Team 3. And what had happened was the guys that I'm about to get signed to, these guys are amazing. These guys are studs. These guys are athletes. These guys are elite. They're incredible. But 2 weeks prior to the end of their last deployment in Afghanistan, literally Captain America, Brandon Looney, I mean, he was Captain America.
Wow.
He gets shot down and dies in Afghanistan. And he was their hero. And he was an amazing human being, And I was going to be attached with him. Right. And mm-hmm. so now here comes Kyle Bucket walking into the platoon space. These guys are, you know, world-class elite. They're hungry. They're ready to take the fight back mm-hmm. to Afghanistan because just took their best friend and their hero. And I walk and go, hey, our mission is a little different. The people that just killed your best friend, we're going to go have dinner with them.
Man.
And we're going to build them a road, or we're going to build them a well for irrigation. And we're going to work by, through, and with them to remove, you know, Taliban and you know, notorious fighters from the region. But we're going to be doing it alongside of them. And we're going to help them build a police force. So we're going to literally go in. I needed to go in and try and figure out, hey, how do I change this culture? How do I change this vibe? How do I change this environment from like direct action
to hunting bad guys and, right. and revenge or whatever, right.
right? Right, right. And then go into Afghanistan and try and change their culture.
Yeah.
So I was like, how do I freaking do this?
Big challenge.
Right? How do you do a culture change internally to then try and go do a double culture change? And so I didn't have this book. Yeah. I didn't have it. And so
You have that kind of helped you get that message across to them? I mean, what was it like? Was it something in your early days, your childhood, your father, like anything that you had that helped you be the person to bring that message?
You know, I think I leaned on the Lord a lot and he helped me do it, but I had an incredible team and I just wanted us to win, right? Like I wanted to have mission success. Simultaneously, I started going down some rabbit holes with Dr. David Kilcullen, who wrote, you know, Accidental Guerrilla and a bunch of books on guerrilla warfare. I actually reached out to him to get his support, and he actually sent me his understudy, Dr. Lee Baggin. Lee, if you're listening, love you, buddy. He became a dear, dear friend of mine. And so Lee and I started working together on how we would do this, mm-hmm. You know, in the unconventional warfare sense. And he was a civilian. And so I actually...
Can you explain a little bit like about unconventional warfare, just for our listeners that may not know about it?
Sure, sure. So the main focus at a very high level, elementary level, is we're going to go work by, through, and with the local population to establish, you know, security in the region, right? Mm-hmm. So what we did in this sense is we built a police force. We built checkpoints with those police force. We trained them from the local population, security force from the local population. We worked with the tribal leaders from the local areas to have, you know, establish some form of democracy in the region. But also just to, hey, once we leave, it's now your show, right? So like unconventional warfare, the main focus is that, hey, once we leave, we give it back to you, back to you. And you guys can have a better, you know, fruitful, less violent, and, you know, environment.
That in and of itself must be challenging to like convince leaders, hey, work with us, when they're looking at, you know, us as maybe a like outsider that's coming in. Yeah. That's, you know, like is that must be a pretty big challenge.
It really is. It really is.
Yeah, you can't just be good at, you know, military stuff. You gotta have psychology, you gotta have, right. you know, tactics that
right.
like people skills, interpreters that yeah. I can't imagine they speak any English.
No. And it's very very elementary, you know, Pashto in the region we were at. So, I mean, and it's very, very poverty stricken to a degree as well, sure. right? Yeah. So think a lot of farming. Mm-hmm. It was interesting, you know, they're farming poppy for heroin.
Right.
Because they can make more off poppy than they can off corn.
Right.
Right. So that you're dealing with that as well. I'm like sure, that's a whole yeah. nother slew of issues. But I mean, yeah,
it's so back to yeah. you, what you were saying, I kind of interrupted you, but, yeah. You had gotten some help from from this guy, right?
Like, yeah, yeah. So Lee and I start nerding out on how we actually do unconventional warfare, which was extremely helpful. And then, you know, slowly over time, Rob Sarver, who was now the lieutenant that took over for Brandon Looney, who had died. So he and I are attached, you know, at the hip. He's the OIC, I'm the tactical leader. And what we decided to do was just constantly, you know, create mantras and rituals to reinforce what we were going to go do, this culture impact that we were going to try to achieve, both with, you know, the internal team, the platoon, but then eventually doing it over there as well.
What was one of the mantras? Can you share?
Yeah. So one of my favorite ones was, well, I'll give you two, actually. We had be quietly aggressive, which means we be aggressive, be very aggressive, like the last deployment you guys just did. But you're going to be quiet. You're going to be quietly aggressive. So you're going to walk in and you're going to go, excuse me, I need you to wake up. Instead of like, hey, get down, get down, get down. It's just going to be like, boom, hey. You know? And we practiced, you know, quiet aggression throughout our entire workup period. You know, working, you know, because in the SEAL teams, before you're deploying, you're focusing on, you know, your tactics, your techniques, your procedures. You're running through houses or you're running through the desert and you're working through all your communications and your drills to make sure that you're fit and ready to go when, you know, shit hits the fan.
Right.
Right. But at the same time, we needed to throw in, you know, the quiet aggression to our scenarios as much as we possibly could.
That's cool.
Yeah. And so that was one, that wasn't my favorite one though. My favorite one was plus one. We had developed a mantra that other platoon members wanted to come, and we had become so tight and we were such a tight crew that, you know, we're living, sleeping, eating, drinking together, all of it, all the above,
a brotherhood. Yeah.
And we had become such a tight crew that other platoon members would joke and be like, hey, no, I'm the plus one today. Because they wanted to come and be with us. So they would be like, no. And so like Chavi or Bobby or someone would be like, I'm plus one. No, I'm the plus one. No, I'm the plus one. You know, so that was a lot of fun. And I'm really proud of that, you know, mantra where we would just be joking and having fun and saying, hey, who's the plus one today?
Who's your plus one?
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So back to your book. You know, the title is pretty bold. Leadership is overrated, right? Because, you know, right. And I think you were saying earlier that, you know, there's a lot of training, there's a lot of effort and push to really get people trained to be a leader.
Right.
Where kind of how does your book kind of go into that? What's your difference in that?
Yeah. So, fun story. I wanted to call the book actually Kill the Leader.
Kill the Leader.
Kill the Leader. And, we're going back and forth with Harper on it, Harper Collins, and dude, literally, we're literally swapping emails about this, and they're like, "Well, we don't know. That's pretty bold, pretty aggressive." And January 6th happens, and they're like, "Yep, literally, no literally January 7th." We're like, "We're not going with that title."
Yeah.
So I was like, okay.
It's funny how events can change. Yeah.
It's still a title of chapter one though. And the premise behind it is in the Navy SEAL community, we do something that's very, very unique. We will, in a training situation, we will literally walk up to the leader, you know, like a Brandon Looney or a Rob Sarver and say, hey, sir, you're now dead. You just took a gunshot to the head. You're dead. You're dead. Lie down. And so the mission continues, right?
Right?
And we get to watch and see what happens when that guy goes down, right?
Like what? Did how you will react, how you will work as a team versus, you know, without the leader.
Yeah. That's right. Interesting. So how do they work? How do they mold? How do they continue going on? And it does a couple of things, right? One, it obviously allows us to see how good the team communicates when that individual is off the battlefield or he's down, and you have to put resources to, you know, to just dealing with that situation, obviously. Right. But it also enables the leader himself, because he's just sitting there playing dead. He's still listening and watching the whole thing.
Right.
He gets to witness how good his next guy is and how good of a job he's been doing to empower that next guy, or, you know? And so it's an incredible exercise. I mean, you can't always, obviously there's situations where you, when and where, and, you know, time and place for everything, but it's a great scenario that allows you to see, hey, did I mentor? Did I empower that next person in charge? Can I go? This is one of my favorite little like hooks that I'll tell when I'm working with companies. Like, hey, dude, can you go down to Cabo for a week and a half and just turn everything off? Like, is your company there? Is it at that point where you can literally go to Cabo for a week and a half and turn your devices off? Can your company survive without you?
Interesting.
Right? Or can it even improve without you?
Yeah.
You know? So it's an interesting concept. So that's kind of the beginning premise around, you know, hey, can you replace yourself?
Yep.
Can you create self-led teams within your organization that are going to thrive, that are going to innovate, that are going to scale, you know?
Because I think it's unhealthy for a company to have such a bottleneck with a leader, right?
Right.
So if for instance, like if I, in your example, died, would my company survive?
Right, right.
I hope to God it would, because that's kind of something that I've tried to build is like, you know, you put people in the right places, you trust what they do, and you can trust that they're doing a great job. And then, yeah, I mean, go to Cabo. I like to go to Punta Mita. Yeah. So,
Oh, my gosh. I was just down in Punta Mita.
It's amazing, right?
It's amazing. We did 13 days down there at Los Veneros.
That's where we were too. Yeah. We love that spot. There's a surf spot right off front. There's another surf spot on the point. You know.
I was surfing it. I was surfing that spot right there on the point. That's like 300 meters down the beach, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm surfing there. And this guy tells me, hey, the woman who lives over there, she literally lives further down, like on the point, on one of those nice big houses.
Up top on the cliff.
Yeah. Yep. He goes, hey, she's been watching a 10-foot shark for the last 6 months.
Really?
Yeah. She's like, it doesn't come over to here. It stays over at that other little spot that like definitely.
When were you there?
May and June.
Was the water warm or was it still cool?
Oh, yeah. No, it was warm. Yeah. It was warm.
Because it's like right now it's like 86. I don't think there's any sharks in the 86.
That's warm.
But I mean, it gets probably down in the mid 70s down there. So you can see where maybe there's some sharks coming by. And oh, man, you've been seeing sharks too out in La Jolla, right?
Yeah. I was just showing him some drone videos of great white sharks and Torrey pines.
Like a bunch of them.
I got circled at 15th Street. So me and Rob, Rob's the managing director of One More Wave. He and I were surfing at 15th Street. This was like, I don't know, 9 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
It was cold. And dude, literally a little fin pops up and did a loop around us, but it was little. It was like, you know, like this big.
Was it just the tip of it, or was it the was it a no, smaller
it was a
guy?
Full. It was Junior? A full. It was definitely a juvenile, white. And then it goes away, and we're like, oh, dude, no joke. 5 minutes later, his brother comes, or his older sister comes over and does a loop around us, and we're like, dude. And we're like, we're kind of like, and there's like three other surfers out. It was a quiet day. There's only like five of us out. It wasn't that good. It wasn't big or anything. And then, dude, 10 minutes later, another one comes by. Bigger. And then the other two follow him, and all three of them just circle us. And we're like, dude, we're out. We're getting out. We're done.
Oh,
like,
man.
It's not that good to stay in
it's
the water.
It's not worth it. I mean, can you imagine? You survive an IED, and then you know,
right.
Oh,
shark,
I don't even want to say it. It's, yeah. Not fun. So back to the leadership thing. Like, you know, our listeners maybe have a real estate team or a mortgage team. And like you said, you know, ability to be able to pull out, how do you go about doing that? Like, what's some strategies you can implement for if you're like a sales manager, you have a team of real estate agents, or you run a small shop? Like, what are some good strategies that you could share with our listeners?
Yeah. It's such a great question. You know, like starting on the branch that you're on, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, are you building an environment? Are you that's really empowering the rest of the team, right? Or are you rice bowling and, you know, trying to maintain control over everything? Now, I've been a part of numerous startups over the years, so trust me, guys and gals, I get it. I really, really get it. There is a time and place for everything, mm-hmm. right? When you're just starting out, like you're doing everything, right? Yeah. Like you're sweeping the floor, and then you're also making sales calls, and then you're also trying to do a deal.
Wearing all the hats.
Right. And so I get it, but there comes a time where you have to start scaling and empowering individuals to take ownership, you know, of responsibility. And really, you know, it's finding that fine balance of when you get to that point, right? Mm-hmm. Like when is your revenue enable to do that? It's different for everyone. It's different for every industry, but like, you know when the time is right where you can start bringing more people into the team. And when you do that though, right, it's all about, hey, what's the JD? What's the PD? What does it say when you initially brought this person in, the job description? Like, are you going to truly empower them to fulfill that role?
Right.
Are you going to allow them to scale with that mm-hmm. role? Are you going to, you know, build a ladder for them to climb? And it's not, I'm not saying this happens in, you know, we live in a society nowadays where everyone wants this to happen in 6 days.
Right.
It takes time, 6 years, you know, to do something sometimes. So, but I mean, are you literally going to allow and truly empower that job description, that position description to really thrive? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. And one of the challenges that I see as a CEO is that you have that balance, like you were talking about before, where people want to be needed.
Right.
And so they take on a lot, and they feel like if they don't delegate and they just do it all themselves, then they're going to be needed and they won't lose their job. Right.
Right.
And so there's this balance where it's like, no, you got to let someone else do their job.
Right.
And you got to, you know, you got to trust that we're not going to fire you because, you know, or like, you know what I mean? Like, so like I'll give you an example, where maybe one employee we've had, they came in and they, started doing everything, trying to wear all the hats, right? And not letting their subordinates do their jobs.
Right.
And so they were so needed by the company that we couldn't get rid of them.
Right.
But you couldn't scale that, right? You can't scale that because it's just the bottleneck happens below. Yeah. So it's like, if I, as a leader, a CEO, if I'm the bottleneck, then that's not good. So, but then if I have the people under me and the people under them, if they make bottlenecks, that's not good either. Right. So there's got to be like a balance between that. How do you deal with an employee like that? Or how do you even take those employees who think or have that mindset to want to be the bottleneck or want to be so important that they won't lose their job? Because the mortgage business is very cyclical, up and down.
Sure.
And so people fear losing their jobs when it slows down. Right.
Sure,
so,
sure.
You know, that's a pretty big problem in the mortgage industry.
Interesting. You know, for me, every situation's kind of different, right? So I understand that and look through the lens of the uniqueness of that question. Because is it someone that needs to be transitioned out, right? Or if we look inside of ourselves, like, have I truly empowered and educated and trained? Mm-hmm. Like, dude, one thing that, you know, everyone just kind of goes, might roll their eyes at me when I'm about to say, but like, it takes 3 years of training to be a Navy SEAL. Like, before you go on your first mission, you've probably been even longer because you've got
to be that person, right? You, like, all your life, like from 16, sure, 17, 18, 19.
Sure. But it takes 3 years to be a Navy SEAL. And guess what? If you show up to obviously I'm retired now, but like, you know, 10 years ago, if you would have showed up to I'm old and out of shape, but if you showed up to my platoon 10 years ago, right?
Yep.
And after 3 years, guess what? You just had 3 years of elite training and education. But guess what? I'm like, hey, dude, I love you, but like, sit down and shut up. You don't know anything.
Right.
You don't know. You just got 3 years
of
very elite training, but you still don't know anything.
You have the experience,
and the reason, and where I'm going with this is, you know, and then, you know, it takes years and years and years of more training, more schooling, more practical knowledge, more on the job training for a guy to become like a TAC lead or a troop chief or a troops OIC, a troop commander, et cetera, et cetera. My point is that we in corporate America so often neglect training and education for our team members. Mm-hmm. And then we go, wow, how do I build an elite team like the Navy SEALs? Well, are you going to spend a decade of training somebody
right
to do that? Or are you just going to blow it off and just go, oh, I'm just going to hire into a qualified person already? Well, what if they're a great, to your question, what if they are a great person that you truly, truly want on the team, but they're creating a bottleneck?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, what do we train and educate and empower them to do to remove that bottleneck? Hmm. Having a 5-minute conversation, or are we going to spend time on training?
Yeah.
You know, does that make sense?
Yeah. It's definitely a challenge because I think there's a mindset, you know, you have a great employee, they're doing so well,
right?
But their mindset is if I relinquish any of these tasks, I'm going to be, you know, obsolete.
Hmm. Well, then that's a great one, but then it goes into, okay, what are the new tasks that they could get really excited about?
Yeah.
And the relinquishing of the old tasks can sometimes work in that manner as well.
I guess probably you just need some scaling training, right? Like the vision of, hey, this is where you're going.
Yeah.
This is where I see you in a year from now.
Right.
So you need to let go of this so you can grab onto this new stuff.
Yeah. It's great. Yeah.
So any special chapters in there before we move on?
The Kill the Leaders Fun. We do. It's not just Navy SEAL stories.
Mm-hmm.
We have Aretha Franklin in here.
Really?
And, you know, the band and her band and what happened and how the culture kind of shifted and molded and into creating, you know, a gold record, platinum record.
Cool.
Mother Teresa, how she got her start and how it, you know, shifted and impacted an entire, obviously, religious culture.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty incredible. We talk about eating penguins.
Eating penguins.
So I mean, we have a lot of fun. I don't know.
You never had one.
I haven't had them, but we have a lot of fun. They're full of protein, but we have a lot of fun, good, entertaining stories that I think really hammer it home. You know, multi billion dollar industry around, you know, training the leader,
yeah.
And you know, 80% of America hates their job.
Mm, yeah.
Right.
I agree.
So, yeah. So we hope to hopefully challenge and fix it, help fix it.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. Let's talk about culture. Cause you know, you had to have being in a platoon,
yep.
Right? You have to have the right culture, and there's probably challenges around that. There's the dickhead. There's the, right. Like there's always someone who's a little like an asshole ability. And there's someone that's like, you know, tell us a little bit about kind of how you build that culture with your team.
Good. I one of the things that I love to talk about two guys and gals about is understanding what motivates them.
Mm.
And I wish I would have learned this earlier on in my career, especially in the SEAL teams as a leader. I wish I would have learned, hey, whatever it is that motivates that individual, it doesn't matter. Like it doesn't matter to in the sense of like what it is. What matters is identifying it and knowing it and then feeding into it in a productive and optimistic and great manner, right?
Yeah.
My point of, you know, here's a great example. The Navy SEALs, right? When we're on active duty, we are meant to be the quiet professional. Well, what happens when you have a guy that is really motivated by, you know, recognition
mm-hmm.
or being in the limelight?
Right.
Right. Like, how do you feed that for a culture that's saying, hey, we're supposed to be the quiet professional?
Yeah.
Right. How do you feed the guy that maybe is, you know, motivated by, you know, financial rewards?
Mm.
Right. How do you support the individual that's motivated by time off?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so what it really comes down to, in my humble opinion, is finding what those motivators are. Those influential things in individuals' life, and then feeding into that in a good altruistic way, because by doing that you're going to get the best out of that person.
Is that like through a survey, or is that just like talking to him, sitting down and talking to him? Like what out of this? You know,
I've seen some surveys work, and I mean, if we go down the rabbit hole of, you know, survey architecture, how you build a an appropriate survey. I've been down it because I ran the world's most elite university. Okay. We didn't talk about that, actually. I ran the Navy SEAL Advanced Training Command.
Oh, cool.
Which was really, really cool.
Down in Imperial Beach. Was that after you got out of the teams? Or?
No, it was my last 3 years.
Okay.
Before I retired. We did 22 courses 90 times a year with an annual student throughput of 2,700 students.
Oh, wow.
So I put.
Is that during that 3 years of training for the Navy SEAL to become a Navy SEAL? Or is that
some of
continued
it.
Education?
It's continued education. Okay. So like sniper school, communication school, free fall school, et cetera, et cetera. So we had a bunch down there. Back to your question, right, is like, hey, is a survey appropriate in this situation? It can be if it's designed and architected correctly.
Because people might be more honest that way sometimes, yeah, right?
Right, right. And if you're going to do a survey, I would spend the time, spend a couple of hours of understanding how to actually design a good survey.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, enough on that. Because, sure. I mean, it's its own thing, right? It's its own thing. I had a team, literally, that I would lean into if we were going to do a survey, around designing something that you're going to get the best output.
Right? Do you have any stories about dealing with, someone that's a kind of a pain in the ass in your culture, in your group?
Mm, yeah. I mean, of course, always. The pain in the pain in the butt could be a different pain in the butt for everybody, right?
Sure.
Maybe it's the person that's always challenging you and it's about you and you don't like being challenged. Or maybe it's the person who's always late all the time, always tardy to everything. Or maybe it's the person who's never organized. I mean, it could be the pain in the butt could be the pain in the butt of anything. But the point of it is like, hey, sitting down and clearly communicating, what the problem is, but then also like, hey, what's going to happen if this is not fixed? And here, I'm going to give you the tools to fix this, but if you're not going to fix it, like, I'm sorry, you're going to have to go.
Yeah.
There's a time and place for everything. There's a time for termination. Yep. Unfortunately, there really is.
Yep.
There really is.
Things aren't a fit, It's right. Just like,
yeah.
Got to deal with it. And
that's right.
Like, we talk about it in corporate culture. There's a cancer, right? Like they it's better to cut it out, separate it from.
Right.
Otherwise, it just grows.
Just festers.
Anything on that?
Yeah, I think you're spot on. I think nipping it in the butt as soon as possible because it's only going to fester and make it worse, right? Like you've got to remove the individual from the team because then it's not going to help the team. Chris actually talks about it in our book. He had, a sales leader that was an incredible sales leader. It was just knocking sales. It was one of the best he'd ever seen, but the individual didn't want to share with the team. They were a lone ranger, and their job was literally, he wanted them to be the sales team leader, right? And back to your point earlier, he was challenged with, I don't want to give this up. Mm-hmm. Right. What happens? And so Chris had to, walk him through it and say, hey, I'm just going to have to fire you.
Wow.
If you can't fix this. And sure enough, within like 3 months, that guy turned it all around. But it was just that good, open, clear communication and like, hey, you've got to fix this or else this is going to be cancerous.
Right.
Because now people are starting to think that I'm allowing that behavior just because you're a rock star.
Yeah. You're a top producer. And
Yeah.
We deal with that a lot in the mortgage industry. It's like you have a real high sales, like someone who's a top producer salesperson, and they get away with so much. And you're like, I can't fire them because then I need that volume. But, it's like it's cancerous and it's damaging the team. And
it's interesting. It's a challenge.
I'm sure it's in all industries, right? You got someone who's like, and they have to have that kind of personality sometimes to be that person that does the sales like that.
Right.
That tenacity and that drive and that kind of sometimes a little selfish, right? Because they're doing it all. They're a maximizer. And, but then there's this balance that needs to come in, and then I guess, from the top down, you have to learn how to mold that person into growing, into not just being that, super selfish.
Yeah. And you know, sometimes there are those types of individuals that are very, very successful in a very one of one individualistic role.
Yeah.
And they can achieve great results. And, you know, maybe they don't want leadership. Maybe they don't want necessarily a team working environment. And at times maybe that's okay. You know, you know, maybe that is okay.
What's your definition of leadership?
I think enabling and empowering those that you've been entrusted with to lead is numero uno for me.
Yep.
Right? You've given this opportunity, you've been blessed to be placed in a position of you know, leadership. Well, are you going to, you know, use that to the betterment of humanity by empowering those individuals that work with you or you work for? We always like to say, you know, I work for you, right? Mm-hmm. I'm here for you. So if you're not doing that, if you're not putting yourself out there for them, then you're not, it's not leadership in my opinion. It's just management.
Right.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
We all have failures in our life.
Oh gosh.
You have to have failures to get success, right? Yeah. Any failures that stand out that you've learned some big lessons from?
Yeah. You know, I was talking about earlier, like not understanding individuals' motivations, mm-hmm. motivators. I wish I would have learned that one a long time ago and how that can really be empowering. I learned that one the hard way. You know, I literally was sitting, you know, a year and a half later, like I'm in Afghanistan with the guys, and one of the guys turns to me and goes, you know, I really would have liked to have done that job. Son of a biscuit, you would have been. And now a year and a half later, because I didn't know a year and a half before his motivation, I'm like, I'm just sitting there like, oh, you would have been perfect for that.
Wow.
And the guy who's doing it would have been perfect for your role, you know? And I just didn't know.
Yeah.
They were like, hey, we were new. We were just obeying you. Mm. You told us to go do something and we went and did it to the best of our ability, but it would have been
better if you swapped
100%.
Man,
you know,
and then you have that lost year and you're
yeah, half, exactly. Whatever. Exactly. Exactly.
How do you now do that? Like, how would you, you know, hindsight's always 20/20, but like today, how would you do that? You just ask the questions?
Or yeah,
just,
yeah. Engaged.
Communicate.
Engagement. Yeah, engagement. Having, you know, I know everyone's so busy. We all get so busy. I mean, dude, I literally had my EA was, you know, working 60 hours a week just trying to keep my calendar straight. So I get it. But like, we literally have to engage with the people that we're working and just make time to do it,
yeah.
Right? To really sit down and understand like, hey, what's going on in your life? What's happening, you know, around, and you know, you can just do it, but you just got to make it part of your mantra, part of your vibe, part of your routine,
yeah.
Or, you know, set aside time to literally go have coffee with people.
Yeah.
You know, I would literally walk around. Like every now and then, if there was a break in the day or something, I'd walk over to my GC, my general counsel. I'd walk over to his office. I'd be like, hey, dude, let's go take a walk around the park. And we just go walk around the park.
Just
no,
chat.
No phones for like, and it was like 12 minutes.
Yeah.
You know?
But those little connection points are huge, right?
Right, right.
Mindset.
Mm.
I know to become I don't know personally, but I know and imagine that to become a Navy SEAL, you have to have this incredibly strong mind and willpower.
Right.
Talk about that and how that leads to success or how you can improve it.
You know,
is it something you have or can you develop it?
I think, you know, I'm going to kind of twist the question a little bit, but
sure.
I think it'll be helpful. I get asked a lot like, hey, is there a crystal ball? Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I ran a couple of hell weeks myself as a trainer years later. Right. And you'd never ever know, like truly, at something like that, like what's
who's
going
make
on,
it?
Like who's gonna make it? Exactly.
Do you ever make like bets and stuff? Like,
oh, for sure, for
you're like,
sure.
Johnny's definitely not making it.
Dude,
Rob is, yeah,
for sure.
I believe.
And dude, you have no idea who is gonna make it and who's not.
You just
like know. I've trained I've, you know, trained some people's kids in my network and like helped them out. And then, you know, it comes down to it. And then like some make it through and then some don't. And you're just like, I didn't do anything different.
There's not some Johnny magical questions Joe. That you could say, like, were you like just a child? Were you this way? Or were you like,
And so, you know, there's no crystal ball. And so what I have determined over the years though, is that the ones who made it through were truly the ones that were not lying to themselves. Mm. The ones that made it through or achieved a goal or achieved a purpose, this or that, you know, I mean, there's 1% of guys who really get injured that would have made it. Like but it's very small. It's really actually very small. So the guys that do make it through are the guys that weren't lying to themselves from the beginning. That were like, hey, I'm truly going to do whatever it takes to make it through. I'm truly going to do whatever it takes to achieve that goal. I'm not lying to myself. I really believe that.
Yeah.
That I can do this. I believe that I can do this, and I believe that I'm going to do whatever it takes to do this. And I'm not really lying to myself.
Yeah.
Others, the ones that quit are the ones that were lying to themselves somewhere in there.
Yeah.
Right? Like they were just not being honest with themselves. Because listen, like, dude, I was not the best physically fit guy in my buds class. There was at least, I promise you, at least probably 70 guys that were in better shape, physically fit, more fit than I was, that quit.
Was there a moment where you're like, I'm gonna quit? Was there ever any like moment in that? You just never had that thought?
Never. I did have a moment of like a warm bed in Hell Week at one point because the water is so freaking cold. But I remember actually having that thought of like, oh man, a warm bed would be so nice right now. And then I literally like smacked myself like, what are you doing? Get that out of your head. Yeah. Get that out of your head, you know? and I was like, man, it's just a warm bed I'm thinking about. I'm not going to quit, you know? But I really believe it's the individuals who are lying to themselves that just ring that bell.
Wow. Yeah. Talk about the next 5 years. You have some goals. Obviously, your book's coming out. You want that to do well. What are the things you're going to do in the next 5 years?
I'm really excited about this. I'm also excited to see where this book lands. So thanks again for allowing me to come here and talk about it a little bit. Simultaneously, I'm in stealth mode right now on another endeavor. We're working on, I got really excited when I was at the data center company around renewable energy.
Yeah.
We were trying to find renewable energy, large renewable energy at scale. And it's very challenging. It's very surprising how challenging it can be to do that. It just doesn't exist, right? Or it's taken.
Yeah.
And so the whole time I was trying to do that, I'm thinking to myself, for the last 2 to 3 years, I've been thinking to myself, man, I got to get on the other side of this. Mm. So right now we are getting on the other side of it and we're working on new renewable technologies that we're hoping to commercialize here and bring to the market in the next 6 to 9 months. I'm really excited about it.
It's a wide open, lucrative business right there.
Yeah. Yeah. We have one technology that can literally convert agricultural waste to like pure hydrogen.
Really?
Yeah. It's really cool. Really cool.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I go down some rabbit holes sometimes and I've seen like where like there's a lot of energy just in freely in this, you know, in the air, right? Yeah. You pull, you know, when you like do a blanket and then the sparks, right? Like, you know, in trees and plants. I mean, who knows where, but there's a lot of energy out there.
We have
you can harness it.
We have one, and I got to be very careful when I say this because it's in extreme stealth mode. It's literally a chemical reaction between elements that could literally replace the Tesla battery at 10% of the size of the Tesla battery and 10% of the cost of the Tesla battery.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's huge.
It's huge.
It's a 10X. It's a 10X deal. Wow.
Yeah.
Any shout outs to people that you already shouted out a couple, but any final shout outs?
So shout out to my partner, Chris Mefford. He was the former head of comms and marketing for Dave Ramsey, Dave Ramsey Solutions. And he's my co-author on the book. He's got some good, fun stories in the book. Shout out to you, Chris. for working through this and being patient with me, pal. Appreciate you. And then obviously my lovely wife and family and three kids, they've been so, so supportive over the last couple of years. So
it's huge.
Yeah. And then thank you, Lord, my Lord and Savior, for saving my life.
Absolutely.
Keeping me around.
Yeah. It was a cool, thanks for sharing that story about that. I mean, I can't imagine what the time slows down probably when you're sitting on a,
right. Like that whole story is literally like a 7 or 8 second thing, but like when you tell it, you know, it's 15 minutes or whatever.
Wow.
Yeah.
How does someone find you?
Leadershipisoverrated.com.
Okay.
Yeah. Please come check us out. We'd love to learn more about what you got going on.
That's awesome, man. Yeah. Well, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, guys.
It's been awesome. If you've listened this long, you like our podcast because this has been a long, long one, but thanks for listening. Please like, share, subscribe, tell your friends about us. And make sure you go down and make a comment. Let us know what you think. And we'll see you on the next podcast. Thanks.
The Million Dollar Mortgage Experience Podcast.